Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Fake news, alternative facts, disinformation, misinformation. None of the above are new, but hyper-fast social media sites and apps have turbocharged propaganda and fake news at head-spinning rates during the Trump era. That era is no longer a blip. It started in 2015 when Trump declared his candidacy, and it's continued to the current campaign. Politicians always have, and always will, bend the truth to fit their narratives, as will ideologically minded media. What's different now is the scarcity of consensus on basic facts and continued broad-based appeal and belief in falsehoods, to wit, that the 2020 election was won by anyone not named Joe Biden, or that it was plagued by voter fraud, or that January 6, 2021 was anything other than an insurrection. Yet, here we are. With me today to help make sense of the corrosive effects of fake news on our democracy are Basir Seka. He is chair and associate professor of political science at Davidson College. Mallory Newell is vice president of public polling at Ipsos. And Amanda Sturgill is associate professor of journalism at Elon University and the author of Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News. Good morning to you all and welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
A reminder to listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, send an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can contact us on Twitter, X, at Charlotte Talks. Mallory, I want to begin with the new Ipsos poll. You found that most Americans blame social media, politicians, TV and cable news, and special interest groups for fake news. But the poll also reflected partisan differences. 20% of Americans define fake news as politicians and media only picking facts that support their side. But you dig into that and you find that 50% of Republicans believe that. And by comparison, 30% of Democrats believe that and 40% of independents. So what do you take from those results? Let's start there.
Sure. Thanks for having me this morning. I think this is really critical to the problem of fake news and the spread of misinformation itself, right? Partisans can't even agree on the basic facts of what fake news is, what it means, and who's responsible for it. So as you said, you know, most Americans say that fake news is just really like false information. However, fewer than half, but pretty close to that number, say that it's when news outlets or politicians only pick facts that support their side of the argument. And as you mentioned, it's really this widespread partisan gap that Republicans in particular feel that fake news isn't just false information, it's when another side is deliberately misleading you, right? So we can't even agree on the basic facts of what fake news and misinformation are.
That's very telling. Basir, Amanda, I'd like to hear your perspective on those results that that Mallory's talking about.
You want to go, Amanda?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I think that the inability to agree on that is important. And I think you actually see that kind of situationally as well, that people will call things fake news at different points in time. They might have different standards, right? So it's always shifting for the individuals. And that kind of creates even more of a problem for that. I think also, you know, I think Mallory brought up a great point about the fact that you have information that's just, you know, factually untrue. And then you also have information that's just misleading. And that the media in particular is less able to keep up with the misleading stuff because of sort of the shrinking of the news industries.
Basir, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I agree with all of that. And I would add that we are up against a pretty formidable force, and that is confirmation bias. We are pretty good at discerning false or misleading news and articles that go against our priors and ideological preferences. But as soon as the misleading information or news conforms with what we like to believe, with our ideological commitments, then it becomes a lot more difficult to discern what is true and what is not. And I think that in an age where partisanship is hyper and society is more polarized, these effects are, I think, augmented, and it becomes even more difficult to agree on these issues because we are quite partial, frankly, in how we evaluate information.
So it's ramping up. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mallory. Go ahead.
I just want to jump in on something Basir said. It's interesting. We've done some older polling at Ipsos that's actually shown this phenomenon, right? This sense of, people themselves may not think that they're in a bubble, but they widely perceive others to be, right? Same thing with the ability to spot fake news. The vast majority of Americans feel that, they'd be concerned that other people in their community would be susceptible to spreading false information, but they themselves, not so worried.
So it's kind of an asking for a friend kind of thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Amanda?
I was just going to say, we actually have a theory for that in communications. We call that the third person effect, which is the belief that things affect other people but don't affect ourselves. And it's pretty pernicious. And I think it's an interesting thing because it's a human thing, right? That we have this susceptibility, but we somehow assume we're better than the other humans at doing that.
I started off in my introduction talking about how obviously, Donald Trump, very different kind of candidate, very media savvy when he came in 2015 and has not left the stage really since then, but also social media. And we, of course, have seen politicians who are, specializing in propaganda, misleading people for as long as we've had politics. Media have changed, whether it's Roosevelt with the fireside chats, we can go through history of people who adapted and people who didn't. Why is the current combination so intense, or is it merely a matter of this is the time that we happen to be living in?
I think we all help spread fake news now. It used to be that you had a limited control over the pipeline of information, right? And so your ability to sort of spread bad news was limited to contacts you had in your everyday life. And now everybody can spread information to anybody. And you combine that with the propensity to sort of only talk to people like yourself, which, is a human thing you're going to do, and also a thing social media algorithms are going to put you in the position of doing. And it kind of creates a perfect storm for that spreading of bad information.
I would add to that that we are no longer passive consumers of news media outlets. We actually are producers of it in real time through our commenting, through our interpreting of various articles that we post and we share on various social media. So this has allowed us to, as Amanda was suggesting, to spread a lot more, but to also be a bigger part of the very creation and the interpretation of these things, as opposed to relying on an objective third party to provide the analysis, to provide the interpretation. We are doing that ourselves, and oftentimes, inaccurately, and tend to spread news that is not correct, or that is, to put it directly, that is false.
That's the voice of Basir Seka. He is a professor at Davidson College. We also have Amanda Sturgill from Elon University with us and Mallory Newell from the Ipsos public poll. Mallory, go ahead.
I wanted to add on and say that I think something that we can't ignore in this discussion is the ongoing decline of trust over time, right? Trust in the media, trust in elected officials and government institutions, and frankly, interpersonal trust, right? And that's not a new phenomenon. It happened before Trump, right? Mm-hmm. But it has been declining over time and is now at historic lows. And so I think we're in this environment where, we are producers of information, as Basir said. We're also, tuning in to the own kind of cues and media that we agree with to confirm our own beliefs. And there's this lack of trust. And I think that creates a perfect storm for how misinformation can spread in this environment.
Yeah, and as you say that, that gets me thinking in some ways, coming into this show, I was thinking about the last decade, as I said, kind of framing it with Trump's candidacy in 2015. But in another way, it's really a 50-year cycle in the U.S. because you start with Watergate, and that really eroded public trust and faith in government. And then you go into the 80s with cable news, and from there, everything speeds up. And so it's just becoming more intense in a way. I was wondering, Basir, I know one of the things that you focus on is international and European politics. I believe you were in Italy before you came to Davidson. We know there are strong men like Viktor Orban in Hungary, in that part of the world. We also know that the European Union tends to be much stricter on technology and media companies in terms of moderating content. With all of that in mind, do you think that the circumstances in Europe are any more or less intense when it comes to fake news than they are here?
It's hard to tell, but I wouldn't say that they are significantly less intense, because the means for spreading and the means even for moderating are fairly limited, what people post and what they share and the basic freedoms of sharing information, of participating in social media are the same across the pond. And so I would say that perhaps historically Americans have spent more time watching news on traditional media outlets. A number of polls have shown that to be the case much more than in Europe. But when it comes to social media, and especially adding the social or the addiction to cell phones and to smart devices more generally, I think Europeans are probably spending as much time as we are in the United States on our devices, where a lot of this stuff happens, meaning both consumption and spreading of fake news. And I do not have much hope in the EU's ability to stem this, because it's not something that regulatory bodies can effectively tackle. It's a much, much broader issue that we all need to be part of in trying to solve.
Amanda.
I think we also get into a situation where you have to be a little bit careful what you wish for. You know, the situation in the United States is obviously a little bit fraught, because we do have those First Amendment protections, mm-hmm. right? And for whatever that is used for, usually people would like to preserve those protections, even if they don't always want them to apply to other people who disagree with them. But there are some good sides to the equal access to produce information that I don't think we should leave out, right? There's a lot of, you know, from an international context, there's a good bit of information about the Arab Spring, for example, mm-hmm. and how social media was used to help organize people rising up against governments that they thought were being unfair to them. A lot of times people will say, well, someone should take over and force media companies to do this, or, you know, we should have laws that restrict the speech and stuff. And ultimately, you know, when you kind of chain that all the way back in a conversation with someone, they're always usually like, well, actually, I think free speech probably was a pretty good idea. So.
And to Basir's point, so much of this is, plenty of it's driven by the media, but plenty of it's driven by the user, the consumer. So that's obviously a huge complicating factor and a difference from years past. I'm curious, Mallory, real quick, we're coming up to a break, but just, and I'll let you continue on the other side. Do you think Trump, when Trump is not on the stage, will it make a difference in lessening fake news to any degree?
Probably not, right? Because we, you know, I'm going to tie this back to the global point that you were just trying to make.
I'm sorry, I asked you after the break in the game. So that'll be a cliffhanger. Mallory is going to tell us about Trump and his effect and leaving the stage. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE as we continue our conversation on fake news.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation about fake news and its impact on elections in our democracy, small d, that is. My guests are Basir Seka from Davidson College, Mallory Newell from Ipsos and Amanda Sturgill from Elon University. And Mallory, I cut you off, so now I'll let you continue your thought on when Trump exits the political stage, what kind of difference it may make on fake news.
Sure, thanks. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, fake news and misinformation are not a concern that's unique to the United States, right? Ipsos has done polling globally that shows that concern about disinformation, specifically its political life in your country, is widespread, right? So this is not something just felt in the United States. And I also think it's important to remember that here at home, misinformation isn't just about politics. Look at COVID. So during the COVID pandemic, you know, there was a lot of misinformation spread about vaccines, about the virus itself. You know, we've, in our research, we've done some experiments where we ask people a series of true and false statements. And actually what we find in some instances is that there's a significant number of people who say that they don't know if a particular conspiracy theory is true or false, right? Sometimes even exceeding the number of people that believes the conspiracy theory itself. And so what that tells me is that regardless of Trump, and regardless of whether we're talking about politics or any other conspiracy theory, there's just this underlying confusion about our common reality that persists right now.
I want to ask each of you about the idea of false equivocation, and this is more politically focused. Journalists in particular, you know, do as much as possible to be even-handed, sometimes to their detriment. You know, this idea comes up a lot in discussing fake news. You hear some journalists and others say that Democrats don't trust Fox News and Republicans don't trust MSNBC or the New York Times. But the fact is that no left-leaning cable news company has come close to paying $787 million to settle a defamation lawsuit because of repeated inaccurate reports of voter fraud, as Fox News did last year. And it seems to me there's a big difference between what sometimes drifts into left-leaning perspective versus the blatant falsehoods that have been aired by Fox and Newsmax. And I'm not trying to take sides. These are just simple facts if you look at it objectively. So what do you think? Do we try to overcompensate to make this on the one hand, on the other hand?
I think one of the problems is that the public is confused about what news is now, because we've had this large variety of alternative outlets. Much of what is seen on like 24-hour cable news of any variety is actually an analysis or an opinion show and not a news show, and people don't always make those distinctions. But I also think, to the kind of earlier point about former President Trump, he had a big effect on the media when he first took office. Media really did not know how to cover him. I remember actually writing to some of my former students who are, you know, working journalists now and saying, so are we using the word lying now in news stories? That was something prior to Trump that you usually would not do, right? You would say someone misspoke or they said this, but it was inaccurate, or, you know, you would kind of elide that a little bit. You wouldn't be as aggressive as saying the word lying. And that was actually a conversation that went on in newsrooms all over the country. You know, is that the kind of language we're going to use when someone is getting up there and saying things that we believe they know are false? So, you know, media, they were kind of attracted to the spectacle. I remember full campaign rallies being carried like cover to cover on cable news, those kind of things. And I just think that I think we had a lot of catching up to do with that.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, as far as the false equivalents, I feel like that is still part of the media kind of trying to find their feet under them. But I think it is better in the news side of news outlets, but often people don't really look at the news side. They look at the analysis and opinion sides.
Basir, Mallory, what do you think?
I mean, I think there's this question of, you know, who do you blame for misleading people? We know that according to our polling, you know, folks say that social media is responsible for the creation of fake news. But when it comes to, you know, actually misleading people or why people get things wrong, you know, after the American public, people, or after politicians rather, the American public tends to point fingers at the media. And on that piece, the question of does the media mislead people, there's a huge partisan gap, which I think feeds into some of this, with Republicans significantly more likely to say that the media is responsible for this, that the media is misleading the public, and that's why we get things wrong. So that's a huge hurdle to overcome too.
Basir, how do you see that?
You know, it's a tough question because it largely depends on your partisan leanings. And I think it largely depends on how those you take cues from portray the media. And in the last, 8 years or so, the media, mainstream media, has been portrayed as being crooked, as being lying. And so you get cues from trusted sources. And I think that divide that we just heard about, the ideological divide, it is generated also by politicians who tend to sow distrust of media outlets. Now, maybe the media is trying, the mainstream media is trying to provide an even-handed coverage of the news, but it's still, it's certainly not succeeding in convincing people that that is happening, because I think that that ship has sailed, frankly.
And Basir, I know you're about to leave us because you have to go teach. That is you, that is your number one priority. But before you go, last question for you. What would you recommend for people to avoid misinformation, particularly things that feed their own biases?
Yes. So this has been something that has occupied a lot of us in political science, and some recent research that I was involved in provides an answer. We were actually trying to see if there is a way to democratize the process of correcting misinformation on social media. Is there a way to go beyond fact-checking, beyond sort of editorial gatekeeping, and use, leverage the power of the masses, so to speak, and use people to fight the issue of false news being or fake news being shared on social media. And we have some exciting findings that I think could have practical implications for people as they're trying to navigate this fairly complicated landscape. So basically what we found was that if you comment, and it doesn't have to be a substantial comment, it doesn't even have to be a well thought out, long paragraph comment, it can be as simple as one word repudiating or casting doubt on a fake news, right? That tends to decrease the likelihood that people will engage with, share, like, or think that the news outlet is or the article is correct. So what this means is that we can all participate in this process, and I'm sure Amanda will tell us how to more effectively discern the fake information to begin with. But once you're sure that something is false, you can easily influence the spreading of it by actually commenting. And what we found is that the strength of the comment, or providing a bolstering link, or increasing, amplifying the comment by providing more likes. This was a controlled experiment, an online survey with controlled experiments from Germany, UK, and Italy. We found that none of those bolstering signals played any role, which lowers the threshold and makes it even easier for us to participate as citizens, mm-hmm. as consumers of these things. We also found, though, of course, it can be a double-edged sword. If you comment, repudiate, or cast doubt on an actual true news story, the same thing happens. People are less likely to share it, less likely to think it's accurate, and less likely to engage with it. So, in other words, you have to be sure that what you're about to flag that someone has posted on your social media feed, you have to be sure that it is, in fact, incorrect. And once you know that for a fact, then you could help reduce the spread of misinformation by simply commenting with a one sentence or even one word comment. And that could be effective in stemming the spread.
Basir Seka is chair and associate professor of political science at Davidson College. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
With that, Amanda, I'm going to pass the baton to you. What do you think about what you just heard Basir say?
I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that the experiment that he did was in the context of providing those corrections to news. I feel like the sort of the use of corrections is mixed in how effective it's going to be. Anything that slows someone down, you know, sort of psychologically, I think is going to help them to maybe reconsider and not spread bad information. So I think those corrections finally kind of fit in with that. It's also very helpful just to ask people questions or ask yourself questions about the information that you see, right? So like, you know, who said this? Is this a person who would actually know this fact? Am I even sure it's a person who exists in the case of some things that show up on social media? You know, and then why am I seeing this, right? Like, why did someone want me to see it? And asking those kind of questions can be helpful for your relatives at your holiday dinner table or whatever. Asking them those kind of questions can be helpful too, particularly if you can do it in a non-confrontational way, right? So, oh, that's really interesting that you heard this. Where did you hear that? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Who posted that there? Do you know that person? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things. If you do it in a confrontational way, they tend to shut down. But if you do it in a non-confrontational way, that can sometimes be helpful.
Speaking of confrontation, I want to run this by both of you. Right after President Trump's inauguration in 2017, Kellyanne Conway, one of his aides, went on Meet the Press and told Chuck Todd that inaccurate attendance numbers shared by the administration at the inauguration were, quote, alternative facts. Chuck Todd found himself in the middle of another Trump misinformation dispute this past week, this time involving his employer, NBC News. It started on March 22nd when NBC announced the hiring of former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel as a news commentator. So let's start with Ronna McDaniel. Here she is in 2023 discussing the 2020 election with CNN's Chris Wallace.
But I don't think he won it fair. I don't. I'm not going to say that.
You're saying you're not sure, as the Republican Party chair, that he was the legitimately elected.
I'm saying
president.
There were lots of problems with the 2020 election, and we need to fix it going forward.
So on Sunday, Todd, who is an NBC political analyst, but no longer the moderator of Meet the Press, was on Meet the Press as a roundtable participant, and he told the current Meet the Press host, Kristen Welker, that it was impossible to know when McDaniel was being honest as RNC chair or since.
Look, let me deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. So I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. Mm. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for it.
So finally, here is Todd criticizing NBC for hiring Ronna McDaniel.
And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination. So it is, you know, that's where you begin here. And so when NBC made the decision to give her NBC News's credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News?
And as we all know, NBC News fired Ronna McDaniel several days after she was brought on board. So I'm curious, what do you think this episode tells us about our current media and political environment?
I, for one, think that NBC probably should have seen the explosion around hiring McDaniel coming. You know, while viewership for NBC Nightly News is more mixed, MSNBC viewers certainly have a liberal tilt, and would pretty naturally take offense at hiring someone so deeply connected to Trump world.
Amanda?
I think it also kind of tells you how much they're willing to invest in the opinion side. We've found for quite a while now in sort of academic research that people engage more around opinion than they do around factual-based things, unless the factual-based things are controversial. Basically, you know, controversy draws eyeballs. And media companies are businesses, and eyeballs are how they make their money. So fundamentally, I think that explains why they might have thought it was a good idea to hire her. I mean, I definitely agree with Mallory. Like, they should have expected that, given the bent of a large part of their audience for kind of NBC Universal, it probably would not go over very well. But I can I can understand sort of this chain of assumptions they made that led to that hiring.
I just wonder, is it inevitable now that we've seen these events play out, that again, people are going to go to their respective silos and say, well, see, NBC, it's just liberal. They don't want any Republicans on, it's only for Democrats. And then on the Democratic side, well, you know, there is some nuance here. She denied an election, but we're not against having Republicans. Is any of that, you know, is there going to be any crossover? Is anybody going to listen to the other side, or is it simply this proves what I already thought to begin with?
Probably the latter. We've already started seeing that, I guess. So,
yeah. And Amanda, do you have any thoughts on how, because all of these networks are obviously wanting people who have recently been in the political wars. So someone who's been an RNC or DNC chair or campaign strategist, how difficult is it to get that diversity of views, but at the same time, you don't want to hire someone, or clearly NBC, their journalism side did not want someone who has been an outright election denier. So is that a complicated world that they're getting into inherently by trying to find people on air who have been partisan?
One of the things I talked about in the book was that maybe you don't want to put people on air live who are likely to dissemble in that kind of way, that you can still get information from them. You can still include information from them, but I think you don't want to just open a mic and say, you know, say whatever you want. And then you have to go back in and backfill, which does not work as well as having good information in the first place. So that would be a possibility. I don't know if that would be feasible in some ways. That's more work, right? It's more work to actually interview somebody and then go back in and listen and edit and do all of those kinds of things. And so I'm not sure they would have sort of the capacity to do that at an NBC level. They probably do, but like at a local news level, they usually don't. But, you know, you could do that. I also don't know if that would be satisfactory to people to provide inclusion in that way, particularly if you did give open mics to some people and not to others.
Well, you both have open mics, and you have a lot more to say. We're going to continue our conversation about fake news and campaigns and democracy. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Our topic today is fake news and its impact since 2015, when Donald Trump declared himself a presidential candidate and social media changed the way we communicate. My guests are Mallory Newell. She is Vice President of Public Polling at Ipsos. And Amanda Sturgill is an Associate Professor of Journalism at Elon University and the author of Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News. With us earlier was Basir Seka from Davidson College. Marty Baron, the retired editor of The Washington Post, told NPR last year that the media must cover this election as though democracy is at stake, because it is. He mentioned Donald Trump's threats to suspend the Constitution and to weaponize the federal government against his political opponents and the media. I'm start with you, Mallory. Do you agree with his assertions, and do you think that that scrutiny is being applied based on what you're seeing so far?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I can tell you as a pollster is that Americans are concerned about people being swayed by misinformation in an election year. And I can also tell you that, you know, when you give people a list of what's the main issue facing the country right now, and you add in not just issues like the economy or immigration, but also things like protecting our democracy or political polarization, those are the things that start to rise to the top. So those are the real concerns for the American public right now. So I think there is a lot at stake, but I think there's also a lot at stake in almost every election in our recent history, right? And I think the question here is, how much does media coverage matter? Because we know that news consumption and where you get your news has such a fundamental view on how people, how partisans view the world. So a Republican who gets their news from fake news or from Fox News, excuse me, has a very different outlook than, you know, a Democrat who's getting their news from MSNBC. And I'm not sure that we can change that between now and November.
Amanda, I want to reframe the question a little bit for you. You mentioned that with Trump's rise, you started to hear from or you started to ask former students about how do you cover an election like this, the way the language changed, not just saying things, as you pointed out, saying that people were actually lying instead of saying they misspoke, but also the language that would be allowed into mainstream media outlets, profanity, for example, because whether it was Trump or someone else, they were actually saying it. So it would go in the paper, on TV or online. I'm curious, you know, how much of a challenge or complexity is this to your students, your current students? Is this on their minds trying to navigate how to cover someone like this or a phenomenon like this? Or is it more a case of this is what they've known since they were in middle school, and so they come into it with eyes wide open?
So it's interesting. I teach journalism students, but I also teach other students at the university in like a core curriculum kind of thing. And I would say students are more politically aware than they used to be, and they resent that a lot, that they have, feel like they have to be. So I think that's a kind of an interesting combination. You know, often I feel like those kind of 18-year-old, 20-year-old Americans have, you know, historically been kind of politically disengaged, and they often don't feel like that is a, you know, reasonable option anymore. But to get back to Marty Baron's point, I feel like the media have to cover every election like democracy is at stake. I feel like there's definitely been issues with the media, in particular, kind of not being able to keep up with the stream of deceptive things that are happening right now, right? Like newsmakers have been shown some techniques that work and now they all use them. And that makes it very difficult. And I think that's what makes someone like a Jeff Jackson get such a large audience for his sort of explainer things that he does on social media and those kind of things. Because people, they want information that doesn't seem all like emotionally hyped. And he presents this very calm face when he does that. But the issue I think we really have is less with the news, because I do think the news has adjusted since the initial arrival of Trump on the scene, but more with the audience, that I feel like we need to be working a lot more on media literacy, getting people to value news, to understand why I might need to like look at multiple news sources, that I might need to question the information I'm getting from any news source at this point, now that news and opinion is blended so much. I feel like that is the key, is something that the RAND Corporation described in a report they did on the fire hose of falsehoods, is putting raincoats on the public. They said that was the only thing that was going to work in the face of sort of demagoguery.
Mallory, I'm curious, your sifting through opinions and giving us a sense of how people are thinking, how people view these issues. And at the same time, as we all know, starting really with the 2016 election, because of the polling that showed Hillary Clinton looking like a lock to become the next president of the United States, there have been a lot of questions and a lot of scrutiny about the practice of polling itself. What's it like to be on that side of it? You know, how have you adjusted to what's swirling around you?
It's a great question. It's one I get often. you know, what I can say is that pollsters are continuously trying to answer these questions of how do we reach people? I mean, methods have changed from 2016 to now, right? We know that there's a huge decline in response rates by people picking up their phones. So more and more polling has moved to online. There's mixed modes that you use. There's different approaches. And so not only are we as an industry, I think, trying to make sure that we're able to reach people, but also trying to look at non-response, right? Who are the folks that are missing from our polls? And, you know, is it really the shy Trump, I'm using air quotes here, the shy Trump theory, or is it something else? You know, we know that there's There's a lot of talk about young people. You just asked a question about it. Young people are hard to reach, whether it's on their phones or they're hard to get engaged to turn out to vote in an election. But I also think it's really important to remember that it's not just how we're doing the polling, it's how the media and how people are reporting on the polling, and that we're not doing a disservice there. Polls are meant to be a snapshot in time. They're not meant to be predictive of what's going to happen in November. So I think, you know, we can continue to innovate and to make sure that we're doing our due diligence from a methodological perspective. But there's also a question of doing our due diligence on how we're reporting on these polls and sharing this information with the public. That's important.
I think that's a really good point, because I think a lot of people look at polls and say, well, that's how it is, and that's how it's going to turn out. And then if it differs, of course, then they may not be so happy. One other item on polling I'm curious about is, obviously, you and plenty of others have shown all of these disagreements, different interpretations of news and media, typically revolving around presidential campaigns, Congress, national issues. Do we see the same kind of disconnect with local politics, with local elections? Any sense of that?
Yeah. You know, I think generally the more localized you get, the better people feel, right? Mm-hmm. They feel better about their environment around them than they do at the state level, than they do at the federal level. But, you know, we live in a society that is hyper polarized right now and is partisan, and you find that at all levels. And I think the one thing that we can agree on is fundamentally the system is broken and it's not working for people. And that's some common ground for the public right now.
There's the good news, kids. That's the voice of Mallory Newell. She is Vice President of Public Polling at Ipsos. Also with us is Amanda Sturgill. She is an Associate Professor of Journalism at Elon University and author of Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News. Amanda, how is the environment changing, do you think? Because as I mentioned, we've had 9 years now of Donald Trump, and social media had been around longer than that, but that all these things sort of collided around that time. What do you see now that's different from, say, 2015, 2016?
Can I go back to the polling question just for
one second?
Oh,
sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, Mallory, you mentioned the media coverage of polling, and that is something that vexes me. I feel like a lot of times the media actually sometimes commission polls just to sort of create news, right? And then they go on and sort of misuse those polls and go off of them for a long time. So, you know, a poll in itself can sort of be a news event, but when you're doing a poll, you know, a full year out from an election and then acting like it's going to represent at all what's going to happen 12 months from now, I feel like you're kind of being irresponsible with that. Okay. To your question about if how the environment has changed, not as much as I would like, maybe. It seems like the environment has changed in that the media in particular is valuing the show, right? The big dramatic thing that attracts a lot of eyeballs. And so being able to create the show is the thing that's going to get you the coverage. And I feel like that is happening to the exclusion of consideration of the issues. I also think the sort of at the same time, the size of the staff who create news has shrunk, but the amount of stories that need to be followed has grown, right? So you've got a major presidential candidate who is in multiple court cases right now, and things are happening in every one of those court cases all at the same time. And it is very challenging to cover all of those kinds of things. And in some cases, you're just sort of running out of people to do it responsibly.
And even, I would say, even in those cases, when you have large paper, the Washington Post, CNN, you know, companies that do have the resources, it's very hard for the news consumer to keep up with everything, assuming that it's all being reported in the way that it should be. It's just a jumble of, it's not just, but it often becomes a jumble of legal motions and lawyers saying this and that. And meanwhile, you're juggling polls and all these things going on. Oh, by the way, you've got to pick up your kids and go to the grocery store. So I agree. I mean, I think it's overwhelming in some aspects, political news at this point.
Well, and for the 9 years that you talked about, right, we've known that people get the majority of their news from social media. And when you get your news from social media, you're tending to get deconstructed little sound bites. So it's really hard to keep up with sort of the big picture on anything.
Melly,
and also getting sound bites that confirm what you already agree with, right? So it goes back to how we're increasingly in an echo chamber, taking in, you know, things that we agree with, that sense of confirmation bias.
And Mallory, I think you mentioned earlier, you used COVID as an example of people, you know, not having the facts straight, disinformation, yeah. Misinformation. I want to ask you, both of you, about a non-political example of so-called fake news. This past week, Kim Mulkey, who is the coach of LSU's women's basketball team, publicly attacked a Washington Post reporter who is expected to soon publish an in-depth profile of her. It's not been published yet. She criticized the reporter's methods and intent, said she wasn't given enough time to respond. Here's some of what she said as LSU started the NCAA tournament.
But you see, reporters who give a megaphone to a one-sided embellished version of things aren't trying to tell the truth. They're trying to sell newspapers and feed the click machine. This is exactly why people don't trust journalists and the media anymore. It's these kinds of sleazy tactics and hatchet jobs that people are just tired of. I'm fed up, and I'm not going to let the Washington Post attack this university, this awesome team of young women I have, or me without a fight.
Now, of course, there is a lot of context that we're not going to go into here, but this reporter has been working on the story for 2 years trying to get an interview with the coach. So it's not as though he just showed up on a Tuesday and said, I need a comment by Thursday. But the part of this that I'm really interested in is the idea of responding to criticism or potential criticism or scrutiny by simply saying, well, it's the media and they can't be trusted. How effective is that, do you think?
She's doing a classic poisoning the well technique here, right? So she is trying to get ahead of the story and make it so that whatever comes out is going to seem less credible because it's been criticized ahead of time. How effective is that? Somewhat effective, I would say. Again, I think that's where like media literacy would be helpful to understand what is a long-term investigation and what techniques they would use to try to get information from all sides. I think it is on the members of the media to be transparent about that kind of thing in the context of the investigation.
And Mallory, from what you see in polling, again, I'm using Trump a lot because he is ubiquitous in this conversation, but there are others, you know, coaches, CEOs, this idea of just hammering away at the credibility of media. Do you find that it works? Is it effective or is it a more limited appeal, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, using the media as the boogeyman is not new, right? This is not a new phenomenon. For me, it raised some questions of like, oh, what is in that article, right? So I don't know if it had its intended effect. But I will say, clearly, she is speaking to a phenomenon that is effective for some people. You know, as I mentioned earlier in this discussion, nearly half of Americans say that the biggest reason for why people get things wrong, get facts wrong, is because the media misleads people. And a majority of Republicans agree. You know, I hate to tie it back to politics, but frankly, everything right now is looked at through a partisan lens. Everything is polarized. And so she's speaking a message that is certainly effective for some, you know, for the roughly third of Americans in this country that identify as Republicans. So yeah, I think there's something there. I don't think it's effective for everyone, but clearly, you know, it's taking a page from the playbook of Donald Trump and other Republican politicians that also point fingers at the media and criticize them.
This is a terrible thing to do, but as we're in closing seconds, I'm going to ask you each for a yes or no, or maybe more or less might be the answer. Are you more or less optimistic about fighting fake news now than you were in 2015? Mallory?
No more or less. I think it's just as critical.
Amanda?
Less, definitely less.
Well, on that happy note, hey, you have to speak the truth. That's part of journalism. We will continue this conversation. I want to thank Amanda Sturgill. I want to thank Mallory Newell. I want to thank Basir Seka. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for joining us today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.